We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good morning.
Good afternoon. Everything in this show actually happened. There were no April Fool's jokes, although I thought about some. But, you know, the Trump indictment seemed to be a good enough stand-in for that.
All right. So that'll count as both good news and humor?
Yes, exactly.
Before all that, starting out with a couple local items. Starting out with something we missed doing the show last week, starting out with an item that was on last week's radar, capital gains tax in Washington
State. Yeah, the Washington State Supreme Court a week ago Friday ruled 7-2 that capital gains tax passed in 2021 by the state legislature and signed by Governor Inslee was in fact constitutional. It's a 7% tax on, non-payroll income, or like, you know, stocks and bonds and things like that over $250,000. So, the thing about it, the ruling though, is that it was very carefully crafted, some might say contorted, so as not to set a precedent that would overturn Washington's ban on income taxes. That dates to a 1933 state Supreme Court ruling. And Democrats certainly had been hoping that this particular court case would overturn that precedent. It did not. So there is still a ban on income taxes in Washington state, which is pretty anachronistic given the 21st century economy that we have. Washington is one of the few states that does not have a state income tax. And as a result, Washington has historically had by far the most regressive tax system in the country. That is to say that wealthy people pay very little relative to their income and poor people pay a lot relative to their income because we rely heavily on sales taxes, which are the most regressive form of taxation. Tax reform advocates have been trying for years to get a case in front of the state Supreme Court that would at least weaken, if not overturn, that particular precedent from 1933, and they thought that this case would do it. But Justice Deborah Stevens, who wrote the majority opinion, really jumped through a lot of hoops to try and justify that income is not income in this case. And if that sounds a little Alice in Wonderland, it is. But yes, that was the ruling. And it's good news for a state budget that we also found out last week is coming in about $1 billion short of its projected revenue. So you would think that the state legislature would be considering ways to drum up more revenue and, you know, that kind of, say, taxing the very wealthy for their obscene levels of income might be one of those strategies, but it's not going to happen this legislative session.
Well, you'd think with our large fair share of billionaires here in the greater Seattle area and the state of Washington, that one of those billionaires would come forward to fill that gap with, you know, just a single billion. A lot of our billionaires apparently have hundreds of billions of dollars.
But, yes, and or as they like to refer to it, pocket lint. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would hardly miss it, but people like Bezos, who can literally feed the world with their accumulated wealth if they so choose, but choose to spend it on other things instead.
Because you can never have too many 1,000-foot yachts.
Yeah, or commercial space programs. That seems to be the vanity project of this decade so far for billionaires.
Investing in what they perhaps perceive as escape lifeboats.
Yeah, that's possible too.
Moving on, Mayor Harrell this week talking about a new housing levy.
Yes, the housing levy that was passed in, I believe, 2017 expires at the end of this year. And so there will have to be a new housing levy on the budget to replace it. And Mayor Harrell proposed one to City Council this week that roughly triples the past housing levy, which in turn was a record when it was passed. This one would be $970 million. And the rationale for that large a increase in property taxes is very simple, that we have a severe affordable housing crisis in this region, and building new affordable housing is expensive, and that's what Harrell wants to do. You saw a lot of affordable housing advocates this week saying, yep, it sounds large, but that's about right. So we'll see what City Council does with it, but that's going to be on the radar for this fall, and I would expect that that will be a very controversial measure because it's such a large price tag. But it's not like the affordable housing crisis in this region is new. This has been going on for at least 20 years that elected officials could have been planning for it. So this is long overdue in all probability. Credit to Harrell. That's not something I say often, but credit to Harrell for recognizing the obvious many years after it was obvious.
But it also continues to foster a system where we are relying on private developers to build those houses as opposed to, let's say, a more a model like social developers.
Yes, and a model in which those developers will develop market rate housing and get tax credits if a certain percentage of the building is quote unquote affordable. In other words, having a mixed model where some units in a building might be affordable and the rest are, obscenely expensive, which is the thesaurus entry for market rate housing is obscenely expensive, at least in Seattle. If you have $1,000 unit, for say a studio, which would be relatively affordable, it's going to be offset by, $3,000 one bedroom units. And that is the preferred urban planning model these days. So yes, they will be relying, almost entirely on commercial development, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, because it just kind of continues to feed the whole commercial development industry, and one has to believe that dollars would go further if, there wasn't a major profit motive involved. So,
well, sure, because you're exacerbating the realist. I mean, it's basically underwriting the commercial real estate market, mm-hmm. and it's exacerbating the affordability crisis because what you're saying is, well, we'll mix in a few affordable units here and there, but we still want to, have population growth. We still want to have more and more of the residential units, even though we're seeing residential units going empty in a lot of new buildings, say downtown and Belltown these days. But the stuff that's on the pipeline for down the road, they just want to build more of them. So, yeah.
I know the city, and you have to wonder if this isn't happening to cities, major cities across the country, but the city is seeing like a mass, maybe not a massive, a large exodus of commercial space in the downtown core. And people have suggested that, perhaps we could convert those over or, modify them to be residences instead. And you have to wonder, couldn't, this nearly billion-dollar levy actually be redirected towards leveraging some of that space downtown?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen because you've got too many interests, like the Downtown Seattle Association, that are really intent on trying to resuscitate the commercial and office market downtown. It looks like, with the census data that actually was released this past week, that this is in fact happening in cities across the country, that it was, a lasting side effect of the pandemic, that you've got, companies now that discovered that, you know, having workers work remotely a few days a week, makes a lot of sense. And you don't need to maintain these expensive office spaces downtown. You can have, you know, satellite offices here and there that are a lot less expensive to maintain for people who come in a couple of days a week. And that seems to be the direction that the commercial real estate market is going right now. Now, whether downtown is going to, that's going to be counterbalanced by the insatiable growth of Amazon, we'll find out. But that's something that from New York to San Francisco to Seattle to Atlanta, you know, all these major downtown areas are experiencing the same thing. Chicago. There's a lot of empty buildings downtown right now. And it's likely to stay that way for a while, but it's likely to stay that way because, you've got landlords who really want to get the more lucrative commercial market as opposed to converting it to housing, which is less lucrative and more of a nuisance to try and maintain. It would make a lot of sense, but that would require that the property owners and property managers actually be on board with that. And they're not right now. Maybe if it stays vacant another 5 years, they might be, you know, convinced, but not right now.
All right. Well, down in Olympia, they are making some decisions. They continue to make decisions. Got 24 days left, I think, in the current session.
Yes, the current session ends on April 23rd. And is likely to end on time. You may remember, you know, a decade or so ago where they would have special session after special session because one or the other chamber was controlled by Republicans and the other by Democrats, and they couldn't agree and they couldn't agree and they couldn't agree. That's not likely to happen this year. Both chambers are controlled by Democrats. Jay Inslee is a Democrat, of course, and they appear to be on roughly the same page. Beginning of last week, since we weren't here last weekend, we found out that the state revenue projection is going to be about $1 billion short of what it was expected to be. And so the House and Senate are both scrambling. The House is set on April 3rd, that is this coming Monday, to propose a budget. And the Senate has already proposed a budget, and we'll see how those budgets align with each other and what major items they have in common. We'll probably look at that in detail next week. Meantime, the bills, the non-revenue bills, are basically have to be passed by this coming week. Bills that are basically raise revenue can still be proposed, but or still be considered. There's a whole bunch of them in committees this weekend. They're trying to cram in the deadline by the end of next week for considering those things. I think one committee had something like 100 bills on the docket for Monday and Tuesday next week. So, if you have a favorite bill that you've been tracking, leg.wa.gov is where to go. They have an excellent, bill tracker. There's a lot of them going on. There have been a handful of bills that have already been signed by, Governor Inslee that are relatively notable. SB 5729, which is a bill to cap the price of insulin at $35, that has been proposed for multiple years. It was passed this year, Some legislators have been waiting for Congress to do that at the federal level, and it's been, you know, proposed multiple years in Congress, but it is not passed yet. So federal government hasn't done anything, so Washington State is moving forward with that, and that's very good news for insulin-dependent diabetics because, a month's worth of insulin used to cost like $5, and in recent years, the manufacturers, particularly Eli Lilly, have really jacked up the price on that, as we've seen with a number of prescription drugs that big pharma price gouges in the United States and then underwrites it in other countries.
And a big kudos to whoever came up with the bogus tweet months back when Mr. Musk took over Twitter, and there was a period where people could just make up accounts that looked like other accounts. And
right.
Someone came up with that one for Eli Lilly that basically said, yeah, we're just going to give away insulin for free now. And it's like, totally shit. And it was a major, like, it totally hit their stock prices. And
awesome.
I think it was a significant catalyst in moving different state legislatures forward on this issue. So
that's awesome because there's something like 7 million diabetics in the United States that are dependent on insulin, both type 1 and type 2. And
yeah,
not all type 2 diabetics are insulin dependent, but the ones that are, it is a significant expense and one that, a lot of health insurance companies still require a copay for. So, you know, even if you're paying 20% of, you know, a ludicrously expensive price, and insulin is something that has been around since the 1920s. It's not like the R&D costs were high. They were just price gouging straight up. So that was very good news to see this week.
Excellent.
Yeah. SB 5486. Did not make it. That was Noelle Frame's wealth tax that she's been trying to advance for the last couple of years. You would think would be a priority for state legislators given the revenue shortfall, but it did not arrive in time to save that particular revenue generating measure. So neither did the state Supreme Court ruling. So that would be a 1% tax on income over $250 million. Will probably be reintroduced again next year, and we'll see what the constitutionality of it is. And we've got a number of important pieces of legislation that are still in the pipeline and hopefully will be voted out of the legislature and onto Governor Inslee's desk this coming week, in particular, some gun safety legislation, some education around education funding and special ed, driver safety. There's a number of different issues that the legislature has been looking at, but you know they're going to try and get all that out of the way this coming week, and then it'll be strictly budget for the next 2 weeks after that.
Moving on then to national, and
yes. Anything happen this week?
Well, I guess they have a new national day of celebration that is going to be included in the Hallmark calendars coming
out. Yes, it's called Christmas in March. Yeah, on Thursday, we learned that Donald Trump is going to face indictment this coming Tuesday regarding his hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels, I believe that's her full name, at least if you go by news accounts. At least one of those counts, some 30 of them reportedly, according to different media outlets, at least one of them will be a felony. So that's going to be a kind of a circus this coming Tuesday. Meanwhile, the DA for Manhattan, this is a local charge, the DA there, Alvin Bragg, who is African-American, has been facing a number of poorly spelled death threats and racist emails and anti-Semitic the anti-Semitic might make no sense until you realize that both Donald Trump himself and then also Ron DeSantis cited Bragg as being the pawn of George Soros, which is a very anti-Semitic dog whistle on the far right. So, yeah, that's been unlocked, and Trump will not be doing a perp walk. He'll be in and out of the courtroom very quickly, and then he'll get fingerprinted in the mugshot, which if anybody in the courthouse wants to make a, you know, cool $500,000 very quickly, they will leak that to a media outlet. And, you know, they'll have him out because, you know, security is a huge concern. And the death threats and, you know, racist messages and all the rest of that, bomb threats, are coming kind of in lieu of Trump's promised, you know, major demonstrations, which have not materialized so far. And that's kind of a surprise because you would think he would pay for some demonstrators until you remember that he doesn't like to pay for anything. So, you know, usually the far right projects what they would do in a situation onto the left. And of course, you know, paid demonstrators is a trope that goes back at least to the 60s, probably to the 30s. But it has not been happening in this case, because, you know, the demonstrations in front of Mar-a-Lago and Trump Tower and places like that have drawn like, you know, 3-6 people. They've been kind of pathetic. So, but, the scene on Tuesday is going to be a circus, not least because of the huge media presence that it will generate. And, we'll find out at that point what the actual charges are. Nobody has seen them yet. There's been a lot of speculation that they, and some reporting that they involve, misrepresentation of business records. That is to say, when Trump, classified the $130,000 that he paid to Ms. Daniels as lawyer's fees. And that he may be opened up to federal charges on that as well. If, for example, he took that as a tax deduction, the IRS may be looking at that. We don't know what's going on with federal charges still. We don't know what's going on with the Fulton County grand jury in Atlanta that we've been waiting to hear from about Trump's 2020 election interference in that state. There are reportedly also investigations into his election interference in Arizona. And of course, the Department of Justice at the federal level and Special Prosecutor Jack Smith have been moving fairly quickly on the investigations into the classified documents that Trump scrolled away at Mar-a-Lago and also to his role in the January 6th attempted coup d'etat. So this may open the dam for further charges. That is unknown at this point. But it's nice to see that at some level, even if it's maybe the less serious of the issues he's being investigated over, that he is starting to face some legal accountability.
Yeah.
And it was very, very, very discouraging to see almost every prominent Republican, including pretty much every Republican that is rumored to be interested in running for president in 2024, lining up to defend Trump and criticize law enforcement in the wake of the indictment's announcement. It really is still a cult of personality on the right in this country.
So it should be a fairly interesting week.
Well, unless they have to postpone it because of bomb threats and got to clear the building or whatever. And that's a distinct possibility. But the security is going to be enormous. It's a pretty complex process to, you know, shuffle Secret Service and an ex-president in and out of a courtroom without anybody noticing.
Yeah, I'll bet. All right. Anything else on that?
No, we had another mass shooting this week, of course, on Monday. That was at a private Christian school in Nashville, in really one of the more affluent parts of town. And, you know, three people dead, another three injured, and the far right has been going nuts on that because
I thought it was six people dead.
Oh no, you're right. I'm sorry. It was six people dead, three students, three staff. That was the deal. So you are correct. But you know, the shooter in this case, who was shot and killed by a fairly rapid police response, was a 20-year-old trans man. He's born female and used he, him pronouns. And people on the far right have been going nuts over this. Meanwhile, also in Tennessee, yesterday, a Trump-appointed federal judge overturned the state law that banned essentially drag queen performances in public spaces. This was the drag queen story hour bill, basically. And it was thought to be likely unconstitutional on its face because you're legislating, you know, a prohibition on speech, basically. I mean, what is the difference between drag queen story hour and, say, a traditional performance of a Shakespeare play where, you know, men are playing all of the roles? There is no difference except for speech and context. And that was the problem with the legislation. So even a very conservative federal judge, ruled that it could not be implemented because the ban was supposed to go into effect this coming week. And that so he gave a 14-day stay for this and indicated it was very likely that the law itself would be overturned. So that was good news. But it was bad news that the shooter in this Nashville shooting, triggered, no pun intended, an awful lot of anti-trans bigotry on the right. And that, unfortunately, seems to be the biggest thing in the latest culture wars. And you can thank Ron DeSantis and a bunch of other people on the right for that.
Well, the anti-trans bigotry was very heavy prior to that. They just saw this, I think, as a potential point of leverage with rallying the troops further.
Yeah, they saw this as validation that all trans people are sick and twisted and blah, blah, blah. Of course, by that logic, you know, the vast majority of mass shooters in this country are cis, straight, white guys. They're not criticizing them as a class generally because they generally belong to that class. But, it's kind of nonsensical all the way around.
All right. And finally, it looks like we've finally opened our state franchises for Tornadoes Are Us.
Yeah, I wanted to mention this because the storms yesterday were another example, and it really wasn't mentioned in media coverage. It's another example of climate change. You had never had that kind of north to south system in springtime before. Usually, tornadoes, they are spawned in the south this time of year along a front that runs east to west. It's a cold front coming down from the north, meaning the warm air from the south. And the contrast between the two is what sets off violent thunderstorms and, in this case, tornadoes. In this case, you had tornadoes from Texas to Michigan. It was south to north as well as east to west. And so you had incredibly destructive tornadoes in places as far apart as Arkansas and northern Illinois and the Wisconsin border, where one person died at a death metal concert. I'm not going to make a joke about that, but insert your own. This is the kind of large, complex weather system that gets generated as a result of climate change, and we're going to see more of it, unfortunately.
And I understand that there were even some tornadoes in California this week.
Yeah, so that is correct. Southern California, no less.
Yeah, yeah, where it never rains in sunny Southern California.
Okay, you are really dating yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm dating myself because I know who sang that song. Albert Hammond.